So, Brica, hey, come here. I want to play this record for you. It's awesome.
Oh, Bueno. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Here, look. And it's like old and vinyl, so I gotta use Dad's needle. Don't tell
him. Oh, an antique.
Oh, yeah, I know, right? Okay, ready? Here we go. Listen. Oh, the record cracked. I think it's broken.
Hi, Sylvester the Jester, at your service.
Oh my God, the record's not broken. It's worse. He's actually here.
Madre de Dios.
Lucky you.
Guys, you are not going to believe who's in our house today.
The most amazing person we know is
Oh my God, we love
here.
Him so much.
Is it Rashi?
No, it's you. No. It's Danny Sylvester, you guys.
Yay!
Oh, God.
Sylvester the Jester.
Oh, I showed up for the wrong episode, man.
No, you showed up just in time. Just in time.
I thought we were going to be, doing Scarlett Johansson.
No,
she was here last week.
She was last week. But you're sitting in the same spot, so the seat's nice and warm. Yeah, you smell the cushions. There you go.
So is a podcast, is this all audio?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no worries about video. We're just audio here.
We can put in sound effects, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, bring mine along.
Okay. How soon after our treatment will my symptoms improve? Most patients report a noticeable improvement in their symptoms within 2 to 4 weeks. Is there any scarring, bruising, swelling, or after the procedure? Why am I'm reading like Woody Woodpecker. I love when Woody Woodpecker reads something in a cartoon. It's like he has to focus his what little intelligence he has, like to sound out the words. And it's like, is there any scarring?
Is there any...
bruising or swelling after the
process. I liked the Woody Woodpecker before they made him cute.
Oh, me too. I liked the Woody Woodpecker
asshole.
He had
fat legs, but that jerk off. The guy who did the voice is good, but I never agree with any of his opinions, which was Mel Blanc.
Yeah. he had a weird voice for him. Like, early on, it was...
Yeah, he was like this here. He was really almost like Daffy Duck.
Yeah.
A little scarier.
And like the first two it was lower. It was like, like his early Bugs Bunny was like, how you doing, pal? Oh no, you put salt on my tail. But then he loosened him up a little bit. Then there were some where he never talked because they couldn't.
Well, he didn't do it later on. I think the wife of the guy who made it did the voice. Yeah, Walter Lance's wife did the voice later.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
Mel did it for the first 3 or 4 cartoons. Then I think Bugs Hardaway did it because he wrote them and he animated on them. And I think Bugs Hardaway did them for like the next 10 or 12 cartoons.
And he was the one who had the kind of herky-jerky way that what he talked. And he would do his voice like this. But they still used Mel going,
for the laugh. And he sued them. And he said, you're using my laugh and you're not paying me. So they said, okay, from now on, we won't have Woody talk, And I think they made a deal just to use the laugh from him. So he was in all these cartoons in the early 50s where he didn't talk. And then suddenly he had to talk again. So then they brought in Grace Stafford and they said, well, she could do the voice, but she really couldn't. And she did the voice of the cute Woody. Oh. And I really didn't like, that was a voice I grew up listening to. It was okay, but then I heard the early Woodies, and I thought, oh, those are much better. Yeah. What's weird is that I guess they forgave everything with Mel in the early 60s because Mel was contracted to do the voices for a series of talking puppets for Mattel, and he did all the voices on them. So he did Porky Pig. A lot of them were voices he did anyway, like Bugs Bunny and Porky Pig, but he also did the voice for the Woody Woodpecker talking doll. And I listened to it, and I'm going like, that's not Grace Stafford. And then I pulled the ring. It was like one of the old ring pull puppets. Mm-hmm. And it was like slowed down. It was like, that's Mel.
Oh,
Yeah, actually.
But they did speed up his voice in a lot of those.
Yeah, they did. They did.
And he's the only one who got credit for any of the Warner Brothers stuff.
That was in his contract.
Yeah, but there's so many other people there, too.
Right? Well, I know, like June Foray and B. Yeah. Benaderet and Stan Freeberg.
Stan Freeberg, I was thinking, yeah, who did?
Yeah.
Hey, Pete Puma. I'm so worried about him.
There was a guy named Count Nelson or something like that. He did... I think that Stan got his job because he died. This other guy...
Who died?
Kent died because he... He died in the war, and he was doing. He did the voice of kind of their like knucklehead characters, like Beaky Buzzard, you know.
Oh, that, I thought that was Clampett.
No. That was this. That was, Bumblebee. Oh, don't tell me now. Don't tell me. But that was it. You know, that wasn't Mel.
No.
Even though Mel kind of took it over later. Oh no. Are the dog's in. Are you eating some milk duds?
I just did.
Yum.
I can't remember who had this. I met this guy at the castle recently.
Yeah.
And he does really, I mean, excellent, silhouettes.
Oh, like cameos?
Yeah, he cuts them. And he was telling me all this stuff about, he did like the best part of... Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is the Daffy Duck.
Donald and Daffy duel.
On the piano. Yeah. And
Dave Spafford, right?
That was the best part of the whole movie for me. I thought that was great. And I was telling him about how I loved, of all the animators at Disney, I don't consider this guy just an animator, but a director and everything, that I liked Clampett the best, you know. And he said, oh, so do I. And he went into... all this stuff, and I said, I'm really not a huge fan of Chuck Jones, even though he did good work and great stuff. And he said, yeah, me neither. And I go, where's that coming from? And he said that they wanted to have Chuck, they were bringing Chuck Jones in to work on Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes, oh, no, let's not do that. He says, I'll tell you what he's going to do. First, he's going to have crack his knuckles like this, and then he's going to put on these gloves, and then he's going to do all this stuff, all this business, take 10 minutes before the thing even starts happening. We don't want that. We want it to go bam, 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 bam. And he brought him in, and he did exactly what he said he was going to do, and they threw it all out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, the weird thing is, like, the Chuck... in his later years, especially without Michael Maltese, who was his like lead story guy, best story guy, I think, Michael. Was he became this weird. He wasn't funny anymore. He kind of aspired to be droll, and he just came off as kind of precious and twee. Yeah. And I love Chuck Jones. Yeah. I mean, I met him on several occasions, and I liked him. But you know, I got to call him on his shit. He got to this point where he actually believed he was this great American humorist, and he was when he was Chuck Jones, but then he tried too hard to be, I don't know, something else.
Well, I think when he did Horton Hears a Who is wonderful. Is that, I mean, even though
the TV special,
yeah,
right?
The TV special was beautiful. Uh-huh. And when he did The Grinch, that was also great.
Was amazing.
Yeah,
yeah. Even when he did some dramatic stuff, he was pretty good. Yeah.
But I really like when he. Did Theodore Geisel's stuff, you know, and that still, I think, is both of those stories are masterpieces of Theodore Geisel's work, and also the Chuck Jones adapting the drawings and making them just a little bit more edgy. You know, that's what's interesting. Chuck Jones will take something into a different direction than the artist really wants to take it. He'll take what is rough and make it cuter, or take what is too cute and make it rougher.
Yeah,
and I guess that's
there are times where something like he'll start off with high aspirations. Like, I don't think the Phantom Toll Booth was particularly good. That was a feature he made based on an absurdist novel, children's novel. It just came off as just arch and twee and sticky, and that's probably my least favorite. And one bump above that, slightly more palatable, only because I love the characters, was the Pogo special he did with Walt Kelly. And it was really like, here are two guys who dance on the edge of sweet, you know, like, but Pogo is legitimate. It can stray into legitimate sweetness. Mm-hmm. And yet Kelly always kept it with kind of an edge, but Jones didn't understand that. So it just came off as sticky and goopy and ill-formed and boring. And
yeah, the thing about it is that when you have that kind of cutesiness in something, it could work if you have the opposite in there as well.
Yeah.
You know? But if it's all like one brush stroke, or if it's all one, what do you call that? One beat or something like that.
It, yeah.
It starts to get boring after a while.
Oh, it's so bad because Jones did the voice of Porcupine in Pogo, and he made him the lead character, and he's a very downbeat character. And most of the special is him walking around the swamp with a present tied to his finger, moping and moping and moping. Pogo and Albert, who are the sparks of the comic strip, are reduced to sideline players. And it's just like, ugh. And it's just like, I thought it was very telling, like Chuck's last portrait that he had taken was a shot of him in his office. And he's wearing a white suit like Mark Twain and a hat like Mark Twain. And he's got a bust of Mark Twain on his desk and a picture of Mark Twain behind him. And he looks like a bad Mark Twain imitator. But he had allowed himself to be given in this reputation of like a great American humorist like Mark Twain. And he quoted Twain obsessively, you know. Oh. But he only quoted one thing. He only quoted this line, a couple of passages from Roughing It, where Twain writes about a coyote. And he calls something like, the coyote is always lonely, he's always hungry, he's always friendless, he's like a misshapen dog with a wolf skin stretched over it. It's like he's trying to apply what Twain wrote about the coyote to his own, like, Wile E. Coyote. And, you know, it's like, well, I'm sure Twain wrote about frogs too, but I never see him. You know, I've never seen Twain. This is very telling. I never saw Chuck Jones quote the jumping frog of Calaveras County in anything connected with One Froggy Evening. And that's like a great, you know, frog story. And I also find it very telling that I think all that coyote stuff was apocryphal. I think he kind of, somebody either told him about that quote years later and he began applying it, like, oh, I was always thinking about that when I directed Wile E. Coyote back in the late 40s. Of course it was inspired by Mark Twain all along. It's like bullshit. I call bullshit on that, because, and I'll tell you why. Because in 1961, Walt Disney did an episode, not many people know this, Walt Disney did an episode of the Disney program called The Coyote's Lament, or The Coyote's Lament, and he opens with that quote because Disney had his own series of coyote cartoons. Like, he had a series of cartoons with Pluto fighting a coyote called Bent Tail. There were only like three or four of them, you know, it's just Pluto fighting another desert animal, but they had enough that they were able to cobble them together into an hour show. And then they had the coyotes talking about how they don't get along with man or the dog. But Disney opened with that quote, and I never heard that quote from Jones prior to that. I think he saw that episode and said, I'm taking that. Yes.
Well, he worked for Disney for a while. Wasn't he Disney? He started off at Disney.
I don't think so.
That's what it said in the book that I have.
Oh, he did? Oh.
Yes. That's why he had that cutesiness in his work that the other guys at Warner Bros. He might have
done some early work early on. I know that during the 50s, like the mid or late 50s, they closed the Warner Brothers animation unit for a while, and he went over to Disney's, and he had this great reputation, and they were all excited to get him over there to see what he was going to do, but he wasn't a very good fit, and he had some real champions among Walt's star animators, but he couldn't, they put him on Sleeping Beauty for a little bit, and he couldn't really figure out, you know, like, how to fit in, and at one point he had a talk with Walt and said, well, what do you want to do here? And Jones said, well, I think the only job here worth doing is yours. And Walt said, well, I'm doing that one at the moment. And so they started up the animation unit at Warner's, and Chuck went back there, which was probably, you know, a good thing, because then he finished out his career doing some of his best pictures over there.
I thought he worked there for a while. I know that he was there for a while.
Maybe early on in like the 30s or something like that. I know that but I think that the stint at the Disney Studios that I always heard about was the short stint, about 6 months over at in the mid to late 50s. But interesting character. I mean, I don't think Mike Maltese gets enough credit. He was like his writer for a long time, and a lot of that stuff, like the Duck Rabbit Duck cartoons and the Drip Along Daffy and Duck Dodgers and stuff came from him.
You know? Yeah.
So I think they worked really well together. I think they bounced.
Just like, what was the guy that worked with Clamp? It was named because with F, or his last name. Oh, geez, oh, man. He has these really, really wacky.
What, writer?
Huh?
Was he a writer or was he?
He was a writer.
Let's see. Oh, Foster. Warren Foster.
Warren Foster.
Warren Foster was great.
Yeah.
You know, and here's something, like, as much as I like Maltese, I think, you know, what's interesting is years later, when they started shutting down the animation units around town for the theaters, theatrical shorts, Hanna-Barbera picked up a lot of those writers to write Huckleberry Hound and Yogi Bear and everything. And Warren Foster wrote, and Michael Maltese wrote on the Yogi Bear show. And Foster wrote all the Yogi Bear cartoons, and they're all great. They all have that dynamic of Yogi and Boo Boo and the Ranger and that, you know, kind of love-hate relationship. Those cartoons are really, really funny. And yet Maltese went on and he wrote Snagglepuss and Yakky Doodle, and those aren't as funny. You know, it's like Snagglepuss talks a lot. He's like Daffy, you know, as a theater guy, you know. Snagglepuss is all pontificating and, you know, he doesn't really do much. He has no adversary, really. He's just sort of either being hunted or
I also like how that every animator and every writer there had a different take on the same exact characters. And so these characters became much more broad in the minds of the little kids or the people who are watching them, you know, at the time. They became much more two-dimensional, much more than two-dimensional, I mean to say.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I asked Chuck about that once because in the early 90s, we had him over back at Warner Brothers when we were doing the TV animation stuff. We had Chuck in for several, you know, like symposiums where we were able to ask him about how he did certain things. And we all had questions about problem solving and animation and how to do stories and everything. And he came in and he told some great stories, but to a great degree, there were things that I had heard before that he had written about. And I kind of wanted to know, at least me, wanted to know some other things. So actually, I asked him once, I said, pretty much what you just said. I said, okay, you have your unit where you're making Bugs cartoons. Frizz is making his. Clampett was making his. McKimson's making his. How did you guys ever meet, like the directors and the story people all sit down together? And did you ever say, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do a Western with Bugs, or I'm going to do a space show with Bugs. Did you ever talk about what's your take on Bugs? Like, did the directors ever meet and talk about it? Never.
Never. I know.
Never. Never. I found that out later, and he just gave me this look like, why would you even say such a thing? Why would you think I would even talk to Robert McKimson or Freeling about that sort
and
of thing?
And he says, he said terrible stuff about Clampett, too.
He's not a Clampett fan, no.
Yeah.
But, you know, I thought, you know, if you've got these characters doing, why wouldn't you talk about them a little bit? But it's... You know, he all he said was, in my cartoon, Sylvester never talked. And then he went on, told a 12-minute story about Marvin the Martian. I'd heard him tell, you know, many times before. But he just skipped over the whole question. And it's like, I guess they didn't. I guess they were, you know, they're making cartoons over here. We're doing this over here. Jones would use his characters like Marvin the Martian and Elmer Fudd.
Jones seemed to have gotten a lot from
from
the old black and whites, Charlie Chaplin and that stuff. His stuff always reminds me of that. Uh-huh. You know, that he got everything that he got from watching Buster Keaton and watching all those guys with the, you know, you know, all the sound effects that were just background. Whereas the other guys, and I'm not a huge fan of I can't even remember the guy's name.
McKimson?
No, McKimson's great. Freeling.
Freeling, yeah, okay.
Not a big fan of Freelings, but Clampett and Tex Avery were my favorites. They were just always made me laugh, always thinking outside the box, always looking at the characters in a completely different way. Sometimes they're very much like animals, sometimes they're very much like humans in the I don't know. That's what always would make me laugh. I'd sit there in front of the TV, mm-hmm. me and my little brother, and had the TV turned down really low. Otherwise, my dad would get up and we'd have to go out and start working outside. So we'd be there and we'd cover our mouth. And like,
oh, if your dad knew you were watching TV, he'd kick you out and make you do chores.
No, he would get up and then he'd say, no, it's time to get to
the outside. Yeah, I had one of those too.
Yeah, and you know, then all the insanity would start. But then, so we'd have to sit really close to the TV, really low, and then we wouldn't want him to hear us laughing. So, it was just crazy.
Oh God, that's great.
And there was a cartoon I saw that we used to. I don't know what studio did it or anything, but it was this snorky character, and it was a dinosaur, and I don't ever remember ever seeing it again.
Oh, that was Clampett. That was like one of the last Beanie and Cecil episodes. He did this cartoon called Snorky, the Snorkosaurus or something, and it was like a Loch Ness monster type character, and it had sort of like a like almost like weird folk music to it, you know, like Peter, Paul, and Mary type of soundtrack to
snorky,
it.
Snorky, snorky,
snorky. Yeah,
there's a little music. I had no idea. Yeah. I've never seen it again except for when I was a little kid, and we both really liked that. We loved Clampett stuff. I just remember.
Like Beanie and Cecil and stuff like that?
We liked that too, but I don't know if we didn't see Beanie and Cecil until much later. You know? And we saw, but loved Gruesome Twosome.
Great.
Which is so insanely violent because that was what our life was like anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and then what was the other one that, one with Daffy Duck and Porky Pig they have to take over for the stork.
Oh, Baby Bottleneck.
Baby Bottleneck. Oh, my
Baby
God.
Baby Bottleneck. Those are great.
And the babies are coming down the little conveyor belt, and there's a turtle, and there's a, I can't remember what it was, a hippopotamus, and he's going, I'm only 3.5 seconds old. And we would imitate that and laugh. And
yeah.
Laugh.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah. It was just,
I love Gruesome Twosome. I actually named my company after a line in that cartoon where Tweety is like, you know, when it's like the little pink version of Tweety, he's walking down the street singing a little song.
Yeah.
The Jimmy Durante cat goes, shh, quiet. Here comes the naked genius now. And I thought, naked genius? What a great name.
It's a brilliant line.
That's the name of my company.
Naked Genius. Yeah.
My production company is Naked Genius Productions. Named after Tweety in his nakedness.
So I just thought that was... God. I loved that, the little dynamite in a tiny, tiny package.
Yeah.
You know, that two of these cats are... And the girl cat just really doesn't give a shit at all. You know, she doesn't care whoever gets me a bird, you know. And I think she goes off with somebody else. But the craziest thing in that whole thing...
The dog.
No.
You don't like the dog?
No, the dog is hilarious. The dog comes in. I'm not supposed to be in this cartoon, but I can't pass up a
chance like this.
And kisses the kid. No, my favorite thing by far, maybe of all times, is when the two cats get in this stupid horse suit, and one of them says, "It's me. I'm the horse's head." And they're moving along, and then Tweety lands on him. Just reaches down into his pocket, yanks out a bumblebee, and just goes slapping him back and forth. And then he pulls the tail out, which is like a cork, and a boink, and sticks this bee in there and plugs it up. And then he doesn't get off. He just grabs on that thing and runs. And it's just like going completely crazy. And then in the end, he goes, you know, he sees this tree coming, and the horse. Parts are just wrapped around the tree. It was just such insane, beautiful, glorious violence and hilariously funny. And then the two cats are sitting there completely discombobulated. Oh my gosh.
It's a great cartoon. And the great element about that segment, the bee is hysterical, but you back it up a little bit. Why did they ever think that getting in a horse costume? Right.
That is exactly the whole
What's point. The thought process of putting on a horse costume so you get close to the bird and get him? Right. Where it's just like
you wouldn't recognize them. I guess
it's like, well, I can just hear them in the room. Okay, now they're wearing a horse costume. Why? Why not?
But also, you assume because you know they probably had a longer version of the cartoon where they're trying to get a disguise, right? But then they don't. Then they find this horse costume, but they both, two rivals, have to wear the same costume together, and that's why the guy says, "I'm the horse's head,"
implying that the other guy is the horse's ass.
Right?
Of course.
Because you don't know how much they had to edit out and cut out in these cartoons. You don't know what else was there before, but it doesn't matter because it was just hilariously funny. It was just to think of something that insane and so beautifully animated, the stretching and distortion is just, oh.
There's just glorious punching in those cartoons. Like, I love Kitty Cornered, where the Sylvester-like cat is going, "We've been skinned out and booted out and batted out, were we men or are we cats or are we mice?
I like cheese."
And he goes smack, and he yells smack, and then he hits him. But now I've got it. The cheese smack, and he hits the little
cat. And he says smack when he does it too.
That's like my favorite version of Sylvester. It's not even really Sylvester, but it kind of is. It's kind of like
he's got an overly sized nose. He's more.
It's a black nose, made more like a clown. But it's the voice. Yeah. And
we've been skidded out, scooted out, backed out, and booted out.
But tonight we were scared.
And then also he does the same thing in that cartoon where, for no reason that you could think of, the cats dress up like Martians from outer space.
They're doing War of the Worlds.
And do the War of the Worlds just to.
And then they dress up like Teddy Roosevelt and chase Porky out of the house.
It's just nutty. I mean, you know, it's so absurdist. It's almost like this, like Salvador Dali or something like that. And just love that stuff.
It's like I always get this word wrong, but you say occasionally you see it in sushi bars. It says like amake, or something. It's like it's a Japanese word. The chef says, "Trust me," you know.
That's what they're saying.
And well, it's like, you know, what do you, don't ask for California roll, don't ask for, you know, your favorites. Just go in and the chef will fix something for you. And that's the same with Clampett. It's like, don't ask. he'll just give you something. And you don't have to, you know. It just, another cartoon I just love, just because the sheer insanity of it is the other Beaky Buzzard cartoon, the Bashful Buzzard, where he's just told out to go out and get something to eat.
Right.
And all the little brothers.
Mom's sending him out one at a time.
Yeah.
You bring home this. And he brings home a baby bumblebee. And then.
Yeah. And then he trades it up for like what he thinks is a turtle.
Yeah. But
it's actually a dragon.
Yeah. Right.
And it's just the insanity. And even digs at other studios. One of the buzzards brings back a whole troop of elephants through the air, and then there's a baby holding a sign that says, "I am not Dumbo."
Right.
So just so they wouldn't get in trouble, but it's great stuff. Clampett was Clampett was here. This will tell you something. The first time I ever went to San Diego Comic Con, it's 1975, and I was like 17. You know, I was all by myself, and I saved up my money, and I could go to Comic-Con, and I was really looking forward to it. I didn't know anybody. And that's when Comic-Con was held at the El Cortez Hotel downtown in San Diego. It was on a hill by itself, and there wasn't a lot around it. It was just, like, on a hill. And I went there, and I checked in, and all I knew was I loved comics. And I would see I saw all these people romping around. They were all really young, and there were people I get to know later, like Sergio Aragonés and Mark Evanier and Marv Wolfman and all these guys, and Stan Lee, you know, they were all there, and they were all just having the hell of a good time, because this was only like the fifth year or so Comic-Con had been going. And back then, they had like a dinner, and you could buy tickets and sit at a table with comic professionals for dinner. They also had a brunch where you could do the same thing, and you could meet like your favorite, you know, like you could sign up, "I want to have brunch at," excuse me, "Jack Kirby's table," you know, and you pay your money, and
they were all still alive back then.
Yeah, they were.
I said,
and I said, "Oh, whose table do I want to be at brunch?" "Oh, I want to be at Chuck Jones's table because he was a special guest." And I was like, "Oh God, I get to meet Chuck Jones." So I Sunday morning shows up, and Sunday morning arrives, and I'm show up, and I can't wait. I go over to the table, you know, table 17 or whatever it was, Chuck Jones's table. I sit down, and there are like two or three other guys sitting at the table, just sort of scattered around, like. And I'm going, like, where's Chuck Jones? And it's like, "Oh, he didn't come." And it's like, shit, okay, well, okay. Well, and this had been turned into, like, the straggler table. So I get up and I go to get, you know, some breakfast. And then this guy says, "Hey, you can eat over here." And I look over and it's Bob Clampett.
All right.
And he has all these, you know, it's like he's got a, you know, pretty full table. But he's like, "Hey, move a chair over." So it's like, With guys with Mo Howard haircut. Now, do I know this guy? Looks like the guy that we be. Oh God, it's Bob Clampett. and it was great.
Did he have his nose back then? Did he have the
he did
yeah, nose
he,
or something like that?
No, he looked pretty good. That was about 9 years before he died, so he was still had the black hair and was wearing the turtlenecks and everything. Yeah,
because
so.
Well, he had some sort of cancer, I guess. had either artificial nose or something like yeah. that went on. Over
maybe
he
had a duel
glasses.
Like Tycho Brahe.
Yeah.
Like what?
Yeah.
The astronomer. Tycho.
Oh, Tycho Brahe, right.
Yeah.
So that was like, I met him twice. And first was at that table. And the second time I encountered him, it was really weird. I was walking. And it wasn't even like to say hello or anything. But I was crossing a street in Hollywood. And I had the crosswalk and everything, and I was going across the street. It was like Hollywood and Highland. And I hear the squeal of brakes, and this white Cadillac almost hits me. And I look up, and it's Bob Clampett. And I knew because the license plate had Beanie written on it. And apparently what had happened was his mind was elsewhere, and I was in the crosswalk, and he almost plowed over me. He goes, oh, are you okay? Are you okay? And of course, he didn't recognize me from the kid from brunch from 8 years before.
Yeah.
But
yeah, remember me? I ate my pudding right in front of you.
yeah. I asked you about Beanie and Cecil. It's like, are you okay? I said, oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. But it was like that moment from Home Alone where Joe Pesci almost hits the kid and goes in the van.
Then he says, okay, and then he really runs.
Yeah,
like
you're okay now. Okay, yeah, there you go.
That would be it. That'd be right.
And then he leans out and slaps me. There you go. Oh, it's so Clampett. But I did get to know.
And you were laying there dead. Oh, it's going to be killed this way.
Yeah. Now I've seen everything.
now I've seen everything.
That's the usual way to get out of oh, God, I love that.
That's from, that was also Theodore Geisel. That was from the, what's it called? Horton Hatches the Egg.
Yeah.
Which was great.
Well, he used the suicide gag a number of times, like at the end of a Hair Ribbon, like the dog underwater shoots himself.
Oh, yeah. That is one of the craziest things to that whole cartoon with the dog underwater.
Yeah, he was told he can't use the filter. Don't use the underwater filter, it costs too much money. So he does a whole cartoon. With bugs on a dog underwater, and the question never comes up is like, how can they breathe underwater if they're just underwater?
Because they're in a cartoon.
Yeah. He also did the suicide. My favorite suicide is the one at the end of. It's the second. I think it's Tortoise Wins by a Hair. It's where Bugs, you know, takes on the disguise of the turtle. And then the rabbit mafia is there to stop him at the end because they think he's the turtle. And at the end, he goes, they help the turtle win because he's wearing a rabbit costume. Yeah. And then at the end, Bugs just goes through the spin. He goes, I'm the rabbit, you fools. I'm the rabbit. And then these rabbit monsters goes, now he tells us. They all blow their brains out.
Now he tells.
That is one of my favorite gags of any cartoon is when Bugs is just furious that the tortoise keeps beating him. He says, I'm going to find out how he does it. And he puts on a disguise, an old man disguise, and goes to the turtle's house.
Is there several of them or something like that?
Yeah, well, that was the first one. That was the one that Avery did. This is the one where they get into this big talk about modern design and everything. And he goes to the turtle's house, and he's just wearing this old man disguise. And
the turtle recognizes him.
He knocks on the door, and he kind of rocks back and forth very slowly on his heels. And we know it's Bugs, because we've just seen him in the previous scene. But then he silently just like lowers his beard and goes, to camera. And then he goes back to rocking on his heels like an old man. It's like, we know it's you. We know it. You didn't have to do that, but thank you. It's so funny that he does it. It's just a little personality bit that just makes it, you know. Like, and that's
the aside, like Shakespeare would have.
Yeah. I'm really gonna get. I need to get some water or something.
Okay.
Yeah, me too.
I was gonna get you one.
Oh, okay.
Ezra, you need one?
I'm good. Thank you.
You
need anything to drink? There's a little seconds where the characters have this very whimsical, childlike, joyful quality to them that you almost have to just like watch for or you miss them. Like in in a Great Piggy Bank Robbery, where Daffy is like waiting for the mailman, and he doesn't want the mailman to see him waiting.
Yeah, because he's waiting for his
Dick Tracy.
Right.
There's a when he puts the mail in the box, Daffy pulls out everything.
Yeah, the 10,000.
He gets the comic book, and there's this the split second where he kind of goes like this. He kind of goes. And then he runs off with it. Just he hugs it to his breast, and then he zips off with it.
I love that man.
Yeah. No, that really, you know, when you see the characters think, and that's when you see the animators think, and they just, it's not just getting the character from.
The other thing I like that it would do is when a character would run, he'd be going from just even a short distance, Clampett would have him go over hills and over, and the camera would follow him in this really fast pan shot where it looked like he ran 100 miles just to get to where it was going. Even if it was a short distance, it would make it look like he would stretch that out and yet do it really fast and have this interesting camera movement where it seemed like the character ran 100 miles. Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is so beautiful. It's like you can have that on a ring.
I love when in Drafty Daffy. Where Daffy's running around the house, and every time he runs,
like fire's coming off.
Yeah, sparks in the fire and everything. He was running faster and faster. Another guy who doesn't get enough credit is Tashlin.
Oh yeah.
And that Misty and I, that's your favorite cartoon is Nasty Quacks, with Daffy as like the kid's pet.
Who grows up.
I love that version of Daffy. I just love
him. What a party.
What a party. Yeah, you would have thought he was a monkey. Come to think of it, he was a monkey.
Mm-hmm. Right?
That's a great one. I like Tashlin, too.
Tashlin's good. He's got some great stuff. And, you know, it's interesting the way he kind of transitions.
I like the fight with the father. Where he fights him with
the butter knife. Yeah. And then he knocks the knife out of his hand, and he graciously allows him to pick it up, and then he kicks him down the stairs.
Boom. And there's, I don't know if he did it, or there's another guy, I always think of Tashlin, that with a, there was a, what the heck's his name? Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of thing with Daffy.
Oh, is that the one where he's like putting on a disguise to frighten Porky? At the house, like he's trying to be like a maniac. That was a McKimson one.
I can't remember what the heck. I mean, I've seen so many of these too many times.
Right.
They're all kind of blurring together in a cartoon that they never were inside my head.
Like, there are times I can only remember images from cartoons that I've seen once. And
yeah, like that one I was telling you about with Snorky.
That was 40 years ago
at least when I saw that.
I'll probably have that one somewhere. You know, Disney never really had... Disney stuff is more uniform. You know, like, they didn't allow for that weird variation. You saw it only very rarely in Disney shorts. But they were well animated.
I never saw Disney shorts.
You never saw Disney shorts? I had Walt running around and...
I thought he was more of a briefs kind of guy.
Yeah.
Briefs guy? Yeah, I think so, yeah. It's, like, his cartoons were well animated and they were cute. And they had some personality to them, but they weren't really... funny.
Well, I think that Disney's problem is that he doesn't really think about the animals as animals at all in his cartoons. I mean, there's Pluto, who's a dog, and Goofy's a dog too, and the dog's as big as the mouse, or the mouse is as big as the dog, and they're just really just people in wearing costumes.
It's like they, you know, there's like a on Planet Disney, wherever that may be, there's like the different creatures have evolved. You know, there are mice. Because even in like the early cartoons, there's like you'd see, there's a cartoon called The Worm Turns where Mickey is experimenting on a mouse, giving him courage formula, and it goes out and it beats up a cat. Then you've got Pluto being menaced by Peg Leg Pete, who is a cat. He's a cat. Here's the weird thing. It's like, they all evolve from stick animals, you know? So in Steamboat Willie, Mickey is clearly a mouse, and Peg Leg Pete, who has two legs in that cartoon, is a cat, you know, because he's got a tail and he's drawn like a big cat. And he was actually a version of a villainous character Walt had been drawn all these years, and then he just sort of introduced him into Mickey's world. And And he went from being a cat to being a bigger cat and a scruffier, tailless cat, and then kind of a dog-like thing. So he's just like a villain, I guess, at this point, even though he's technically a cat. But it's like Mickey is kind of like a meek little guy, so he's rendered as a mouse. Donald is Bluster, so he's a duck. And Goofy is an amiable guy, so he's just a hound dog or something. And yet within that world, there are dogs and cats. And right. And you know, it's like, what's surreal to me is like when you see Donald sitting down to eat a turkey dinner, it's like, wait a minute. Yeah. What poor unfortunate relative of yours wound up on the plate, you know? Yeah, exactly. It's just like, well, at that point, he is a human. He's just drawn like a duck, and it's one of those just weird ass things.
I think that the Ren and Stimpy, those guys must have thought about that too, because they often play off, you know, Ren and Stimpy would suddenly look like a dog and a cat, just like a dog and a cat.
Yeah.
Just remind you, hey, this is a dog and a cat, folks.
Yeah, it's like they're in a pet shop window. Hey, here's a human. Look cute.
Look cute. Look
and they just put in a photograph of a dog and a cat, or yeah, a really nice rendered painting of them. And, you know, yeah, you just have some fun with it and stuff like that. So I think that I've heard some of the old time guys like Ward Kimball say, well, that's what killed the shorts, is we couldn't make Mickey a mouse anymore, or he couldn't give a mouse, like, he just became a little guy in a suit. And it's like, well, yes and no. I just think that you could always do stuff with him. You can always do stuff with any character. It's just, you just have to establish you're in a world where, you know, he's just, some people are horses and some people are cows and some people are mice.
Some people are assholes.
Oh, yeah. quite a lot.
I would love to see a Mickey Mouse cartoon where he's like living in a hole in the floorboards. And
it's like,
they've never done that, have they?
Well, no, that's how he really does live. They don't pay him much anymore. So, yeah, you know, he's lucky to get the work. And, that last cartoon they made with him was pretty good. The Get a Horse cartoon was a lot of fun.
I didn't see that.
That was, you know, didn't see that one?
No, I probably was out of the country.
We have it, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
We can show it to him.
It's called Get a Horse?
Yeah, we'll show it to you. It's very cute.
I watched Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs the other night just because I hadn't seen it in a long time. And I wanted to see it because I remember, you know, liking quite a lot of it. And the dwarves are very, very good characters. Their personality, each individual character comes out, each individual's personality comes out in everything they do. You know, like Sneezy doesn't move the same way Grumpy does, and Doc is all up here kind of like pontificating and talking like this. And he's always, he's the leader, but he's kind of like always delicate, I just want to say now listen up, now we have to do this for the princess. He's all up here, Grumpy's all here, Sneezy's up
tell
here.
Tell the people at home what you're doing, please.
Oh, I'm crossing my arms. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. When I did Doc, I was like, you know, like little meticulous gestures in front of, you know, like he's always speaking with his fingers. Grumpy delivers almost every line with his arms crossed. Yeah. Sneezy's almost like looking up all the time, like, because that's the only way his nose stays clear.
Dripping.
Sneezy, did I say Sneezy or Sleepy?
Sleepy.
Sleepy's just out of it. He's just off sawing logs in the corner. Bashful is always tying his beard in a knot. And beyond those things, is every time they had a line or they moved or they spoke or something, there was that personality. And you look at those characters, and it's so great. And I think, and I listened to it with commentary that Walt had done throughout the years. I mean, he never sat down and did commentary to picture, but he spoke at length about how he created the movie over the years. And he says that the big failing of that movie is the prince, and to some degree Snow White. And he said, if we had had a little more money and a few more months, we could have really made that a terrific picture, because they didn't know how to do the human
characters. Yeah.
The queen's fine, because all she does is pose like this she's command scary, and stand in one pose. And once she turns into the witch, then you can have a lot of fun
with
her.
The other two characters are kind of bored. Snow White can sing, and she's beautiful, and she's kind, and the birds come and land on her. So you get the aspect of her character without them. But this definitely wasn't as fleshed out as the dwarves were.
Well,
they definitely weren't having as much fun with it as they did with the dwarves.
I don't think Disney trusted either the character or maybe the audience to accept Snow White as somebody who would be a little bit more fun. And he really depended on Grim Natwick, the animator, to bring her to life. And he actually says, thank God, you know, or so, he really, not quite that, but you can hear that he's grateful that he had Natwick who had animated on the early Betty Boops and made her, you know, an interesting and fun character to do Snow White. And the time she's most fun is when she's up and she's dancing and singing and playing around with the dwarves and everything. But the prince, man, he's a total lox.
Yeah.
I remember reading a comic book adaptation they had done, or a comic strip adaptation they had done in the 30s. They had reprinted where they...
Disney did?
Yeah, well, he was a master of promotion, and even before a movie would come out, he would put out comic book versions and comic strip versions to let the audience know, and it was, you know, because there's no TV, like, the movie is coming, and these are the characters you'll see in the movie. And there was this whole subplot with the prince trying to get back into the castle to see Snow White, and it was sort of like what they did in Sleeping Beauty, where the queen kind of welcomes him in disguise, and then they attack him, and they're going to chain him up, and he escapes, and they were really trying to put that in the picture, but they didn't know how to do it, you know, because suddenly you're designing and, you know, guards and soldiers, and you have to move this guy, and the prince is such a drip anyway, because he can't hold his own. You put him on screen against Dopey.
Yeah, he's you don't even like want to look at the guy. Too.
Yeah, 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 yeah. You've got these great vaudevillians,
right?
Wide-eyed and energetic and running around, and then you've got some guy who's just like he wandered in from Gulliver's Travels. You know, hi, I've been badly rotoscoped into the scene, and I'll be leaving now. My horse doesn't move either, so sneezy and bashful,
if you could
help
anyway.
Me carry the horse out.
Yeah. He's just a mannequin, basically.
His horse is just a couple of cats in a costume.
There you go. It all comes back to a couple of cats in a costume.
The people at home heard that before you guys did.
Yeah. But that movie was... They had ironed out a lot of those gonks by the time they got to Pinocchio, and Pinocchio was
I thought Pinocchio was before that.
No, that was two or three years after. Snow White was 37. Pinocchio was late 39 or early 40.
Huh, I thought Pinocchio was first because it was a shorter film, and that Snow White was a first full-length animated film.
Pinocchio was feature length, too.
Yeah, Dumbo was the only short one.
Yeah.
And Dumbo's short? Feels long.
Dumbo's like 64 minutes.
Feels like it
minutes.
Goes on and on.
What? No, I love Dumbo. Oh, that's a great picture.
Yeah, I like Pinocchio
boring.
A lot better.
Yes, it's boring.
Dumbo's terrific.
I didn't say it wasn't terrific. I just said it was boring.
Oh, okay.
She has the thing against elephants.
I do.
So, you know, it's like Disney knows how to, you know, Walt knew how to cut a scene just so, because I he would cut a lot of stuff out of his pictures, even though you'd hear later, like that stuff's really good, you know, why did he do that? Like he had this whole sequence where Geppetto was swallowed by the whale and he's out searching for Pinocchio, and it was all storyboarded and they had mapped it out. They hadn't animated it, and he looked at it and he just would go over the stuff and he goes, you know what? We can get all that information, like the blue fairy sends him a note, you know, and then Pinocchio hears his dad's in trouble and it just makes him determined to go. Because at some point, Pinocchio is going to have to find out that information, and the audience is going to have to sit through that information again. You see, the audience will see Geppetto get swallowed by a whale, but Pinocchio doesn't know that, and somebody's going to have to tell him later. So you might as well, you know, save time and effort, and we can throw a more action at the screen later. You know, but that what's really interesting is like Snow White isn't really Snow White's movie; it's Grumpy's movie, and because he's the character who changes in it, and then. Pinocchio is Jiminy Cricket's movie. He goes from being a cynic to a believer at the end.
You know, Jiminy Cricket in the original story is dead.
He's dead, like halfway through the second chapter.
Yeah, he steps on Jiminy Cricket.
Oh, he hits him with a hammer and just...
Oh, is that what it is? And steps, and then it's his ghost
and
his guilt that is his conscience, basically, where that whole thing comes from. I guess, I don't think it would put that in a Disney movie, though. There you go, Cricket.
Well, they had a lot of trouble with Pinocchio because he was too nasty. And they said, an audience isn't going to buy him if he's just as bad as Lampwick, you know?
Yeah.
If he's just that rude and irreverent. However, they will feel for him if he is naive and led astray.
Right.
That makes him more sympathetic. And if he's led astray by comical bad guys like the fox and the cat, you can kind of like those characters because they're more roguish, whereas Stromboli and the coachman are just out and out demonic.
It's interesting how some things will work in a literary form and not work in a visual form.
Oh, yeah.
Like the if I don't know if you ever read Forrest Gump, uh-huh. the story is like nothing like what they put on screen.
Really? Oh yeah, yeah.
The story is so hilariously funny. So it's my favorite story of all time, and it's nothing like the movie. He's an idiot savant mm-hmm. in the story, but Rain Man had been done already, mm-hmm. and the guy who wrote it, I don't know if you know, he was a Pulitzer Prize winning writer. He won the Pulitzer Prize for a Vietnam novel, and the guy in the story also he has sex with Jenny Curran every which way till Sunday, and they even did it on top. We even did it on top of the refrigerator. I don't know how we got up there, but and he talks like retarded through mm-hmm. the entire thing, but he just is. He ends up an astronaut, ends up all these crazy things, and. But when they made a movie out of it, they had to think about what's already been done, and they had to cut out all this other stuff in it that makes the character in the book far more. It was one of the few books that I was able to read in a day, and I couldn't put it down. There's a scene in that book that is the funniest thing I've ever read, seen, or anything. Should I tell?
Sure. Yes, you should tell them.
Okay,
make them
so
want to
Forrest,
read it.
Forrest Gump becomes he's a ping pong champion in the movie and in the book too. Uh-huh. But he's also a chess champion. He gets to be an astronaut at mm-hmm. one point, mm-hmm. and they put and because he can do this fantastic math in his head instantaneously faster than a computer, they figure we'll put him on the ship instead of this heavy computer we have and save a lot of weight. And they ended up, that is my phone, that probably was before too. So they put Forrest Gump in there and there's this orangutan, and they're supposed to have a female orangutan, but they have a male orangutan, and he whatever pees on something, and the ship crashes in Borneo, and he meets this headhunter guy who's educated in Oxford, and there's a bunch of pygmies too. And so this guy was educated in Oxford, and they explain why. He explains, well, what happens, and he always explains like he's a retarded person, that during the war they would take these people off the islands and they would educate them in these other countries so that when if the war did break out, they could use them for their places for landing or whatever. They would be on their side. So he meets this guy, and the guy's likes to play chess. Forrest Gump doesn't know how to, but he plays chess with him, and he learns all this stuff, and he becomes a really good chess player. So the way later in the movie, he gets in this chess contest someplace, and he's beating everybody around. Then he ends up in Russia, taking on the world champion in chess. And he's doing something called the Pygmy's Revenge, this move that is like nine moves ahead. You know, you have to think nine. And the guy's moving his... looking at it, and this Russian guy, he be looking at it, and he moves his queen forward, and he looks at it around, and he keeps moving, and he move it back, and he move it forward, and he about to take his hand off, and everybody kind of lean in real close, thinking, he gonna take his hand off, and all of a sudden, I lets out the biggest fart of my entire life. It was like somebody tore a big old bed sheet in half, and he gets up and he's waving his arm around, and I look down and I notice he took his hand off the queen. And then later on, they tried to call the game on the cup, but there was nothing in the rule book that says you can't fart. I just had to stop reading it because I was laughing so hard, and I was crying and laughing. And it was the funniest thing I ever read. And they cut out, and that was one of two hilarious things in the... And also, he uses all these racist words because he doesn't know any better. And he was raised in this racist South. But he said, but that's what the character is like. So that's another reason they couldn't stick exactly to the...
Interesting. Yeah.
And that just reminded me of like what we were talking about just a second ago, how things work sometimes in the movies, they make it one way, and a book is different. And you know, it's animation, cartoons, and movies are different than you know, anything literary.
Yeah, right? I mean, you know,
because everybody reads something, sees a different thing in their head.
The ending of Snow White in the story is the queen goes to the prince's wedding. You know, because it's like the neighboring prince is having a wedding, and the queen is invited, and she goes, and lo and behold, the bride is Snow White. And then as soon as she walks in, they catch her, you know, for her three attempts at trying to kill Snow White, not just the one. And they take her and they put her feet in iron, in red hot iron shoes that have been heated on a fire. Oh. And they force her to die until she, or dance until she falls down dead. And that's the way that they kill her. Now, you know, I can't see that the ending, like the wonderful little dwarves fashioning iron shoes to, for any reason. It's better that they chase her through the forest. And it is odd that, you know, after she leaves the cottage, not one of the dwarves, like Happy or somebody, doesn't stay back to make sure Snow White's okay.
Yeah.
They just, they were going at that point. They see her leave. They figure Snow White's already dead. They're out for blood. They chase her up the cliff. And then she basically gets struck by lightning. It's Deus Ex Walt at that point. But it's
Deus
a great...
Ex Walt?
Well, you That's know how... funny. Yeah.
No, I was just appreciating what you said.
I don't know what that means.
It's a good ending, you know.
Instead of Deus Ex Machina, it's Deus Ex Walt Disney. Deus Ex Machina, the god
hand
of the machine.
God. Yeah. Deus Ex Machina is the hand of...
Yeah.
The Greek term.
Yeah.
And, sorry, I didn't have to catch up on my Greek.
Well, so this we, Greek we didn't to me. Really
but the ending
much
is
time yeah. to really, you know.
You know, they're wrapping up the story, and it's a nice, you know, your energy is up, you're involved in, oh, what's going to happen, and then that's a good ending, is to have, you know, throw her off a cliff. Unfortunately, they did that with every other Disney villain, because you can't just pull out a gun and pop their head off.
Well, you don't want your good characters to be murderers either.
No, I mean, you know, when they bought the rights to they bought the rights to a book called The Fox and the Hound, which was an award-winning novel, and then and you know, they made a movie out of that, and they just said, they said this can't really be a story about a fox and a hound who grow up in proximity to each other and then grow up killing each other. Let's make it more like, you know, friendship kind of overcomes everything. What? Yeah, I mean, you know, they encounter each other when they're little in the book, and then, but they're basically, you know, he's a wild animal, and he's, and there's no anthropomorphism. Yeah. But at the end, you know, the dog stands over the fox and won't let the hunter kill him. In the book, he chases Todd till Todd dies. His heart basically gives out, and Copper shakes him to death, and then Copper gets old, and the ending of the book is heartbreaking, because the farmer goes back and civilization encroaches on, you know, where he lives, and gets more and more built up, and he's going to have to go to an old folks' home, and so he just takes Copper out back and shoots him.
Oh.
That's not the happy ending. It's better, you know, the movie's a lot more entertaining. Not much, but, you know, a little
there's
bit.
There's no singing gargoyles in Hunchback of Notre Dame, you're telling me? Is that...
Not that I know of, no. Mm. No, he's a monster all the way through that,
oh,
you know.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's not Judge Frollo. It's, you know, he's like a priest or something in there. In there, he's a, you know, you can't do these. I thought they really missed the boat on Tarzan.
Oh yeah,
they totally soft pedaled that. That is in no way Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't really like the. I like kind of like the art in, but I didn't really like Quasimodo. You know, the
Hunchback
of Notre Dame either.
No,
I mean, because the movie has one of the greatest scenes of all time in it. I don't know who the director was, but just the way they froze, it's just like time is frozen for one moment in the film.
Uh-huh.
And there's no audio whatsoever. You just see Quasimodo doing something, and the girl's about to die, and this guy from nowhere just swings down and swoops her up and takes her away, and all of a sudden the crowd just bursts into, and it's just so powerful, that scene. And that's with the Charles Laughton.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I was gonna say,
freaking,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think they made some odd choices in some of their, if you're going to make a monster movie, you got to make a monster movie. You know, you can feel some sympathy for the monster, but you can't be all just huggy kissy at the end with the monster. I mean, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Frankenstein's monster,
he still has to be a bit grotesque, and that you have to make you want to love the grotesque and care about him. And
yeah.
Nothing else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think they're, you know. But anyway, we got off the subject that the stuff wasn't really all that funny.
Yeah.
I mean, Song of the South is kind of funny. Brer Fox and Brer Rabbit are funny.
That was funny.
Those are just characters who were designed to be funny and get on each other's nerves and try and kill each other, and that's funny.
And Roger Rabbit was funny.
Roger Rabbit was funny. Roger Rabbit was funny.
Funny.
And
The shorter ones were funny. Like, was it Fancy Free or...
Fun and Fancy Free?
Fun and Fancy Free, and all the ones with, like, the few different episodes in it, like, the, you know, the dragon...
Reluctant Dragon.
Reluctant Dragon ones.
Pecos Bill was funny.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Pecos Bill.
That's a lot of fun.
No, it was... There's a very funny Donald Duck ones, which is horrible, too, where he makes his nephew smoke all this.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one. Yeah.
That's a great one.
Yeah. Donald is unrepentant in those. And there actually is a cartoon I like a lot. It's not, there's a one great gag in it, in Symphony Hour. That's one, a later one that had Mickey and the entire Mickey Mouse gang in it. And there.
Oh, is that where Elmer Fudd? Oh, no, I'm thinking about Warner Brothers again.
This is like Pete is like an impresario, like a radio host. He's got this Italian accent. He's like he's sponsoring the Symphony Hour, and he hires Mickey and his band. And so Mickey is coming out, and he's playing. You know, Horace Carler and Goofy and Donald are all playing classical music. And then they get the job. You know, they pass the audition, and they get the job to go on the air that night. And then Goofy falls down the elevator shaft with all the instruments and crushes them. Mm-hmm. And there's no time to get replacements. So Mickey doesn't know this.
Crushes the other characters? Or
No. He falls down and...
He crushes it. Blood is everywhere, running into the aisle.
It's like, I don't know how he managed to survive that, because he falls down the elevator shaft and he gets out of the way, but the elevator crushes all the instruments. And then he has to go on and put with the instruments as they are. And so they go from playing classical music to a Spike Jonze arrangement of the same thing, you know, with weird sound effects and everything. They're just doing Spike Jonze music. And as Mickey is trying to conduct, and he's losing it, and he's getting very frustrated, and Donald is like looking through the want ads, and finally Donald just gives up, and he's headed for the door. He's going out, and Mickey zooms in out of nowhere and shoves this gun in his face and just goes, "Get back there," with this big agonizing grin on his, you know, clenched teeth, and Donald runs back and finishes it up. That's the best gag, and I think somebody complained about that because he never ever did anything like that again. It's like Mickey pulling a gun? No.
Yeah, it's more likely to pull a switchblade, I think.
Yeah, Mickey's kind of like a shiv. Knife guy. Yeah, he'd shank you. He wouldn't shoot you in the face. He'd come up behind you and shank you.
Or tase you.
Or poison you.
Yeah.
Okay, we have to stop because Ezra's giving me the time signal, but we're going to pick this up next week, you guys, and we're going to talk with Danny about magic because we've been sitting here talking about animation this whole time. So next week for some magic.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter @RadioRashi or @Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.